Hi everyone, welcome to Beyond the Benchmark, the EFG podcast. My name is Mo Zafzal, I'm the Global Chief Investment Officer for EFG. So today we have Jonathan Rauwitz and Henry Walters. Welcome gentlemen on the podcast. This is, call it an update to the podcast we had in June 2023, which actually was one of the most downloaded podcasts we had of 2023. Of course, the very important topic on artificial intelligence. So, Jonathan, let's go straight to you.
So we've seen a big investment in infrastructure, and the headline poster child of this has really been what's happened with NVIDIA. But we have seen some very good progress on the model. So one of the interesting thing about the models is when we spoke last, they really only took text inputs and gave you text output, but you're starting to see models that can produce images, audio, text. ChatGPT's integrated all of this into its model, so you can now get it to make pictures for you, so that's a big step up. We've seen them pilot Sora, which is essentially their video generation technology. That's a big step up in ability to create content, all at zero cost, at least to the user. We've also seen Google launch Gemini Pro, which has meant that you can actually put in a lot more text into the field to get answers, and that's a big step up. And we're seeing all of the big guys producing AI models talk about next generation models with far more parameters and far more capability. So basically, we're building out model capability, but we still haven't seen enormous adoption of AI into enterprises. We know that they're pilots, so I think the way to think about it is ChatGPT was launched in 2022. 2023 was all about companies developing roadmaps for how they may be able to use this technology, so brainstorming, I would say. 2024 is about building proof of concept, so starting to build little tools that you can run at small scale to see if you generate usable output or save cost. And I think 2025 is going to be about scaling these things. So the thing we've seen in that space is the launch of Microsoft Copilot, which happened in March of 23, and they made it available to a few enterprise customers in November of the same year. We've seen ChatGPT Enterprise, we've seen NVIDIA AI for Enterprise, and we've started to see the big cloud providers provide AI as a service, so Amazon Bedrock, Azure AI services, and the foundational models at Google. So it's really still the beginning stages of things, but we've seen a big step up in investment. I think that's the key thing we've really seen.
Is this all about the big companies winning and smaller companies not winning? I know maybe we'll talk a little bit later about regulation, but how do you see it today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that people realize is that running these models is super expensive and that we don't have enough supply of the chips to do this. So when you talk about the Mistral acquisition, that was all about a model that was very capable, but actually was much quicker and needed much less compute in order to run things. So I think that there is a lot of competition around how do we make this cheaper and easier to implement. And, you know, that's which way that it breaks in terms of that answer will determine whether it's just the big guys who've got the capital and the scale to be able to run these models if it's expensive, and potentially if it's not that expensive to do, to produce very good content, you might see a whole lot of new entrants because the barrier to do this will be low. And I think Microsoft's acquisition of Mistral was trying to get into a model that is low cost, trying to work out what's going on there, potentially prevent disruptors from the bottom coming in and taking away what they've got with OpenAI. So I think it's still an open question. The technology is at very early stages, but it's certainly something that's super important to watch in terms of model efficiency from a time and cost perspective.
I think just one caveat, Microsoft didn't acquire Mistral. They invested, joint investor in Mistral. You might be thinking of Inflection AI, which they semi-acquired.
I guess, I mean, that's the other point, is one of the issues here is that tech can't go out and do big acquisitions because they're limited from a competition perspective. So acquisitions these days look like signing deals where you acquire all the talent and you do a deal to pay the company royalties, which is essentially effectively an acquisition, but not an actual acquisition that can be challenged.
You're right, Henry. I think these are strategic investments, and as part of that strategic investment, there's probably a bit of Microsoft Azure and other sort of, you know, cloud-based stuff sort of snuck in there with, of course, access to NVIDIA chips to help. One thing I want to sort of bust now, because I think it's quite interesting before we go on, is around the algorithms themselves. So I guess what we've seen with open source algorithms versus, say, proprietary sourced algorithms, that actually the gap between open source and proprietary is narrowed substantially. So an algorithm that's running a particular search or whatever it might be, or a query that you put in, that is basically coming to the best it can be. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, I mean, I think the debate around open versus closed is all about the incentives of the people producing the models. So the biggest proponent of open source models has been Meta. And what they really want to do is they want to spread the usage of AI models and get people to adopt their open source models to produce engaging content for their platform. So they want as many people to use this and adapt it for content creation as possible. That's their incentive. The closed source models are very different. The closed source models are, you know, companies like Google, companies like Microsoft with OpenAI, who essentially want people to use the centralized closed model that they run, not adapt it, but just, you know, use it as a let's say a platform to generate content on their cloud services. So it's very different business models. The one is selling, you know, server time and compute capacity and AI capacity, which is Google and Microsoft, and the other's selling advertising and wants to use AI to generate, you know, more attention on their platform. So I don't think it's a matter of which model will necessarily win. I think it's a matter of what you're trying to use the model for will determine which architecture you use to achieve what you're trying to achieve.
I guess the whole point of the Mistral investment is if you can find something that's much more efficient, then that's kind of where the next stage of the battle is going to be. Because once you've got, say, a big model and it's very expensive to run, you're going to start working on outcomes to find a much more efficient platform to get it down to, I guess, what people are talking about is, you know, have it on your iPhone, right? If it's personalized just to you and your activity, the best place to have it is actually on your phone, because it'd be faster, quicker, et cetera, and cheaper. So I think maybe, you know, that's something I guess we'll watch and we'll see how that evolves. But I think it's quite interesting, because I think it's not necessarily where the proprietary sort of edge sits at that level. Maybe on the efficiency in the future it could be, but as I said, I think it's probably a little bit too early to figure that out. So turning to Henry, obviously the biggest challenge at the moment is chips and infrastructure. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, sure. So maybe taking a step back and doing a bit of a review of you know, 2023 as a whole in terms of the boom in investment in AI infrastructure. So in terms of the AI chips, or commonly referred to as accelerators, the market was about $45 billion sold last year, just for the chips alone. And then when you include kind of all the other server components, CapEx that goes into the buildings, the networking, the cooling, et cetera, you know, estimated investment in these data centers of around kind of $80 to $90 billion. And just for context, in terms of the annual investment we see in data centers globally, it's around $250 to $300 billion. So, you know, you've seen potentially a shift of kind of the magnitude of 20 to 30% of that data center CapEx shift away from traditional CPU-based compute infrastructure to this much more AI-focused infrastructure. And obviously the main beneficiary of this has been NVIDIA and the NVIDIA supply chain, including all the memory and foundry and all the other suppliers that go into this infrastructure. And the other interesting point is that it's been a relatively concentrated customer base. So, I mean, for NVIDIA specifically, over half their sales go to about four key customers, which we've already touched on during this conversation. But you know, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and Meta combined are the key customers investing in this space. You know, with the remainder being other smaller cloud providers as well as enterprises. But the key point, I think, which Jonathan touched on it, is that despite this massive surge in investment from these companies, it's actually been a supply-constrained market, so they still haven't been able to deliver, you know, enough to satiate the end demand. So that's what's happened. You know, all the key customers and the entire supply chain are still very bullish for this year, even into next year. You know, all the big cloud and Meta included have continued guiding to ramping up more AI investment in the infrastructure this year. So we're likely to see that to continue for the near term. But I suppose, you know, the ultimate question is, how sustainable is this investment? Are we in a bubble? Are we at peak hype? Are we not there yet? Is it going to keep ramping? And yeah, there's a wide range of kind of potential scenarios, and it all depends, I suppose, on how monetizable and the return on investment on this infrastructure that these companies get, you know, which we can touch on in terms of kind of where we are in terms of adoption. But maybe just, you know, to put some bullish numbers out there, which get floated around by some slightly biased members of the industry.
Surprise.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's some vested interests here, but, you know, in terms of AMD have floated the $400 billion TAM for AI chips in the data center. That's in 2027. So that's not including all the other CapEx. That's just the chips, which is, you know, well ahead of where expectations are.
10x over the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. After, you know, just a little 3x last year. You know, Sam Altman of OpenAI has, you know, been reported to float that $5 to $7 trillion number. That's total infrastructure spend, not over a specific timeline, but just investment in AI as a whole. And then, yeah, some interesting articles the past few weeks on Microsoft and OpenAI in discussions to invest potentially $100 billion in just one AI kind of supercomputer data center. So again, you know, these all come from slightly biased sources. But there's some very big numbers if you want to paint a very kind of bullish blue sky scenario on how far this could go.
And I think if you look at other sort of bubbles in the past, you know, thinking about, you know, when the internet first came about, you know, everyone laid tons of fiber, and obviously that fiber eventually got used, but it took a lot longer for that fiber to be used. And I think obviously there was a huge amount of capex that went into that, whereas today one could argue that you know, they're not big projects. These things are, you know, we're talking about 1 or 2 years, where if you're laying, I don't know, a global crossing fiber network across the Atlantic would take obviously a lot longer. So I think the amount of spend is obviously you know, pretty big. Difficult to know where that ends, right? So I think, and I think anyone who's making any kind of forecast probably shouldn't really be believed, because they've probably got zero visibility into actually, you know, the real true number. I think one thing we can say is that we'll probably overhype it in the short term and underhype it over the long term. And I think that's generally been the psychology of human nature when it comes to these sort of things. I think there's one other comment or point, just I guess alluding to early on the algorithm discussion, is that what you typically find with these sort of big capex spendings and technology spends is that technology also infiltrates them, you know, those items themselves. So can we get more efficient, for example? You know, can we produce, you know, more with less power, as an example? So I think all of those things are just a real unknowns. This is a multi-dimensional model for us to try and think about. It's not just about the TAM. It's actually all the technology is going to mean that TAM is probably going to be smaller or spent in different ways. And I think that's you know, something we certainly need to be cognizant on. But you know, moving to today, Jonathan, where are the battlegrounds? You know, where is the fight going on at this point in time? Obviously, we talked about NVIDIA, you know, and you know, the whole world knows about NVIDIA and what they're up to. But you know, where are the other battlegrounds that are developing?
Yeah, I mean, and the battlegrounds are where what really matters in terms of investing into this this particular playing field. So I guess the thing is, it's obvious that NVIDIA had a head start and it's got an advantage, at least in the short term, in selling chips for AI. But I think it's still an open question whether they're going to be the ultimate winner or how much of the market they will gain. So there's still a very good chance that a different architecture essentially wins. And so the question will be, how much does AMD or Broadcom have of the overall market for chips? And the other players that are very meaningful are the actual cloud providers themselves. So, you're seeing Google launch new chips, all to try and not have to spend on NVIDIA's expensive chips. And the same is true of both Amazon, Microsoft, and Facebook. So there's a very good chance that the one of the key battlegrounds is, do they all need to just buy NVIDIA chips or can they do it themselves? And I think the answer is that it's probably going to be all of them. The question mark is just how much in each. And we don't really know that yet. They've got deep pockets. They've got good knowledge. Companies like Google are extremely well positioned to develop their own in-house chips. They've been doing it for years. So we'll see later on. I guess one of the key things that's being debated and something that's being super watched in terms of NVIDIA's numbers is there's a big difference between training models and using models. So we know that NVIDIA's chips are very good at training, which is the very expensive part you have to do right at the beginning, but then most of the compute in the future is probably going to be in usage. So we might have some of the competitors have optimized chips for usage, which take a huge chunk of the market. So NVIDIA is very good at now giving us numbers as to exactly how much inference they're doing, which is the usage of the models. So the question mark will be how much can they retain of the inference market. The other big question is in the foundry market. So who's making the chips? And that's something we're watching. And then there's, all the other stuff around chips like memory. So, who's going to create the memory chips that are most compatible doing inference or model training? Who's going to be the winner there? Is somebody going to break away and be able to produce something special? So that's another layer of battleground. And then if you want to go right down and technical, we all know that what's happening with transistors on silicon is that it's becoming harder and harder to put more transistors on silicon. So that's all been, in the past talked about in terms of Moore's law, which is breaking down essentially. So it's becoming harder and harder to get a high amount of compute out of chips. And there's a lot of competition in the semiconductor equipment and packaging space as to who's going to be able to produce the technology that allows us to get performance out of chips. That with the same amount of transistors. So can you glue the chips together? Can you create chiplets with more than one chip together with subcomponents that will allow you to get the performance? There's a whole battleground going over there. So it's not all about NVIDIA. So from a portfolio manager's perspective, it's very interesting to look through the whole stack and say, okay, where are their mispricings? Where could be the next winner that goes along for the ride as this change happens? And potentially that's much more interesting than just buying the headline name.
No, absolutely. I think that that's going to be super interesting to watch out for. And I guess there's the obvious things like the semi equipment manufacturers who are going to be supplying that, all of that sort of power. And of course, with the CHIPS Act in the United States, there are already country winners. We've seen Japan winning. One could have been surprised, but Japan certainly clearly is one of the bigger winners here, as well as the obvious ones in the United States. Arizona seems to be the most popular one for the US side. But all of that is super interesting. Is there anything in Europe?
Yes. I mean, so Europe's got some amazing semi equipment manufacturers. So they're basically a key component in building machines that use light to etch transistors. And then BE Semiconductors, which does packaging, which essentially means once you've etched the chips onto the silicon, you etch many chips onto one big piece of silicon, and then you cut up the silicon, and then you basically put the silicon into a package, which looks something like a black square with some pins on it, which then gets plugged into the actual computer motherboard. So they have a technology, where they've just developed a technology called hybrid bonding. Hybrid bonding is a leading technology that allows individual chips to be glued together, at a very, very, very microscopic level, and still allow them to perform in parallel and in tandem, which ups the amount of performance you can get out of a chip. That's a completely new technology, Dutch-based company that's, you know, got a bright future ahead of it in terms of having this technology penetrate and allow computer processing to remain something that evolves very quickly. So yeah, there are winners all over the world.
So moving maybe one lens back up again and looking at some of the kind of big strategic questions that we still don't have much answers for. Henry, do you want to sort of break that down for us?
Yeah, I think another interesting topic, which you mentioned earlier, Mose, on kind of being able to run some of these models, smaller models on your phone potentially, you know, commonly referred to as edge AI. Edge meaning anything that's not in a big cloud data center. So that could be, you know, it's like running computation on your phone, your PC, your Meta Ray-Ban glasses, all these kind of these gadgets and tools. And yeah, I think it's just worth highlighting it as I said, it's not a kind of massive big market relative to the kind of centralized cloud AI story that's unfolding now. But it has, you know, potential over the longer term, as you said, as material benefits to moving this stuff, these intensive computational tasks towards people's phones. That it's not going to take up all this capacity in the data centers. It can just run locally on your device. There's, you know, security benefits. There's latency improvements. So there's real reasons and benefits of doing these computations locally rather than in the cloud. And you're seeing a bunch of products start, you know, whether it's all marketing hype, you know, AI phones, AI PCs are launching kind of last year and this year coming to market. You know, Samsung has the Galaxy S24, which they market as an AI phone. Google has Pixel 8, Pixel 9, which they're now incorporating some of the Gemini Nano smaller models, and then the value that could create. But we're still, you know, relatively earlier on in that kind of edge AI discussion relative to the cloud.
Is it fair to say then about edge AI in particular, it's more like the consumer product companies that could really incorporate that rather than the big behemoth sort of B2B type companies? Is it fair to say that that's kind of where the guys and girls who can do it really well at that level, you know, typically have a consumer?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You need to be selling a device in some form to get these in people's hands. But it could also have applications, I suppose, outside of consumer applications, like industrials. You know, it kind of ties into like robotics, and all those kind of fit into this as well. But yeah, you're still shipping these kind of devices.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very useful framework to think about it in terms of the two elements. And then we already touched upon the open and closed models. Anything further to add to that discussion we had already?
I think we covered the key points. I think the only other point to add is, you know, what was leading edge 12 months ago quickly becomes standard. Yeah. So yeah, it changes very, very quickly. And when the open source catches up with the closed models, right, you know, GPT-5 will be around the corner and we'll all see what the hell that can do.
Yeah, what's coming new. But then the fact is that edge is so fast. There's probably no value in it, right? So if everyone else can do it on an open source basis and giving it away for free, that means the value that you have is just time and how much progress you can make in that time. And if it's only 3 months, 6 months, or 12 months, quite frankly, that edge is gone very quickly. And really, we shouldn't really assign as investors any value to that. And I don't think people quite understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is very important to think about, because there is a risk that, that the ability to generate models becomes ubiquitous. We land up with basically a few companies with valuable data and a lot of companies with sort of generic data. There is a real question about where's the value going to be captured longer. And I think with any of these things, the way to think about it is that in tech, generally what wins is ecosystems. So it's the ability to take technology which might be commoditized, but package it in an overall system that really generates, you know, a lot of long-term value. So if you just look at, for example, the Apple ecosystem, email is ubiquitous, photos are ubiquitous. Many of the things that they have in their products are offered by other companies, but it's the whole seamless package together. So I think it's going to be about how companies use AI to strengthen their ecosystems, and the ones that do it really well will generate values, and the ones that don't, it'll just be a commoditized thing.
So, I guess taking that sort of discussion further on, you know, where are we seeing, you know, monetization today around AI?
Yeah, so I think I'd probably put it into three different kind of buckets. And firstly say, well, two out of three are very early stage in terms of proliferation, adoption, and critically monetization. So the first is kind of package software products that incorporate generative AI features and functionality. So the headline ones are really, which we touched on earlier, but Microsoft Copilot, that's across Microsoft 365, as well as their GitHub Copilot. And, you know, it really got rolled out for large customers only in November 23. So very early days of adoption there. Adobe Firefly has been the other one that's seen some traction, launched kind of more widely in September 2023 before being in beta. And then you've got a very, very long list of, you know, I dare you to find a software company that isn't incorporating AI or Gen AI in some functionality.
It's a kiss of death if you don't mention it, right?
Exactly. So, you know, you can go from, you know, Salesforce to ServiceNow to any kind of large enterprise SaaS business is launching these features, but we're still early in rolling them out, monetizing them. So it's a key area to watch. And so particularly tied to the discussion earlier about how sustainable this investment is, we need to see these products get adopted and kind of monetized. And then, so that's one area. The second area, which is a bit, it's not as tangible today, but you see a lot of companies talking about it, or CIO surveys mentioning this stuff, which is, you know, I suppose companies adopting this technology for their internal processes and systems and applications. And again, that's particularly in kind of pilot phases. There's a lot of, as I mentioned, surveys around companies and when they plan to roll out these kind of products. And it can be anything from, you know, customer support, summarizing, drafting documents, data processing, content creation, and more domain-specific tasks. But, you know, the questions most CIOs or chief information officers are asking is how can we automate and augment our internal processes? And it's mostly about kind of saving costs and automations. And that's, you know, as I said, largely in kind of pilot development phase, not in full production. And, you know, to your point earlier on, you know, I think there's a, on kind of how over enthusiastic people are in the short term, there's that, it's the Bill Gates quote where we overestimate how much we can do in a year and we underestimate how much we can do in 10 years. So, you know, there's a lot of intent to roll out these features, but intent doesn't necessarily mean they're going to deliver them in the timeframes they provided. So it's an area to watch, not saying it can't happen. I think it's good to have a healthy dose of caution and skepticism when looking at some of these planned rollouts for a lot of these features and products. And then finally, just the third area, which is probably it's the most profitable area today, so it's just worth mentioning, as that's a key area of monetization of a lot of this infrastructure, but it's mostly around digital advertising, and it's not as, you know, on topic as generative AI, but it's a big application of AI generally, and that's mostly building kind of recommendation engines.
And talking about those companies in particular, does AI disrupt the existing business models? And are they willing to take those steps? Because I guess that's the big debate. Certainly, I know we have this debate in the office, right? So. You know, what is, it's a big question, right? Are they willing to take that on?
So I think, so let's look at each one separately, because I think they're completely different stories. So for Meta, I think it's only an enhancement, because they can now use AI models to prove to advertisers what the return on investment for that advertising is. So they can use it to target people and show that spending advertising money on their platform is good. The other thing for them that is super important is they're going to use AI to generate content to get people to look at those ads. So from, I think, Meta's perspective, AI is super important. And in fact, one of the amazing things about them is they bought many of these chips pre the big NVIDIA surprise on the upside. So they had the foresight to already get in the queue, and they've bought a lot of capacity here. And that capacity is going to help them do all the stuff I've just mentioned.
They may also actually become a metaverse company, despite changing the name maybe a few years too early.
Yes, I mean, I guess if you're going to really put your imaginative goggles on, and this is something people have been talking about, is the metaverse could be something that is AI generated, right? So if we've already seen video generated, you know, maybe they'll use some of these chips to create virtual spaces, which is what the metaverse is, using AI. So there's no doubt about it. It's all lined up in a way that's good for their long-term strategy of selling advertising and potentially launching the metaverse. I think with Google, it's a lot more complicated. So Google's got more data than anybody. Google's got the capacity to do the compute required to have these models generated and run. Google's probably the longest standing company involved in AI. Its founders are passionate about AI. In fact, you know, they're involved in the current generation of the current Gemini model. So Google is an AI company. The real question around Google is they've been very good at giving you 10 blue links every time you log on, right? And they've worked out how to fit 10 blue links onto your smaller screen in the mobile form factor. And they've been monetizing that. I mean, they're the world's leading online advertising platform. The question mark will be, how do they integrate AI into their business model without slowing their current growth? So that when people look at Google near term, people are worried about short-term growth because we're not sure yet how they'll do it. They have to figure this out. And there's a very high probability that they do. But there's an equally high probability that we have a gap in growth before they launch the new products. The question mark is, what will the journey be in terms of winnings? It's just a matter of risk-reward near-term in both different companies.
So let's maybe talk a little bit about the controversies just on that Google topic. Obviously, we had the whole sort of misleading sort of demo features of Google Gemini, and, you know, everyone's, you know, quite upset, you know, about some of the output. I won't go into too much detail about what the output was, but it was certainly controversial. And of course, you know, the general view, and it can be political bias, so we have to be a little bit careful about that. But, you know, a lot of this stuff, I guess internal control mechanisms they put in actually destroyed the product or messed up the demo, right? So how much of that is going to get in their way?
It's super important. So if you just think about Google search as it is today, if you search for something on Google, what it does is it gives you a menu of options. You pick what you want as the answer. So whatever your biases are or your preferences are, you can find an answer in what they give you. With generative AI, they give you one answer. And the problem is that answer is not going to be right, and I use that in inverted commas, and in all senses, for every single person, because all of us are looking for different things. All of us have different values in our societies. So a really big question mark is, who decides what that one answer is going to be? And it's a very big debate. Do we want do we want Google deciding what the truth is, or do we want Google to give us a range of different alternatives? And it's very political. I think it's a huge unresolved issue, and it's a super important one when it comes to developing product. As we've seen, making the wrong choice here is going to bias who does or does not use your product, and potentially what regulatory consequences there are from doing this. So this is a massive open question: who decides what the single truth is?
I think ultimately that's the bigger problem. So I guess my next question is should that be government, or should that be Google or Meta or, you know, Microsoft?
So that's a very philosophical question. Personally, I don't believe government should decide what the truth is. I'm a free marketeer, so I think that what should happen is that different companies should make their choices around the, let's say, controls on the output, and we should, as consumers, be able to look at different platforms' answers and decide which ones are the most helpful or the most reflective. And the companies are going to have to be very good at working out how to make the most of that opportunity, or at least avoid the landmines.
And so obviously there's a lot of talk about regulation around AI, and specifically around this topic. We've got, you know, major elections coming up, and you know, there are some, I think Henry, you mentioned a little bit earlier, the OpenAI are not going to launch their...
Yeah, they've held back on launching specific features and products. I think it was an audio focused product, is kind of, or voice mimicking, and you can imagine, you know, having Biden or Trump say certain things with AI generated audio ahead of an election year can be have pretty detrimental effects. So you've seen a lot of these companies, they said, kind of self-regulate and hold back in anticipation of the potential backlash they might receive on some of these products. There's a healthy dose of caution.
And I think the other thing we've obviously seen is sort of Elon Musk is having his own crusade via X, or formerly known as Twitter, as I think the official response is these days. But he's taking a different view.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the two views are give people what you think they should have, which is kind of what we saw with Google. They adjusted people's prompts to give a very particular lean in the output. Whereas Musk's view is just, you know, create complete transparency. So when somebody posts something, allow the community to criticize the post or label the post, so that you kind of know what you're looking at. And I think it's a big question mark around which is the right version of things. I certainly don't have the answer, but I think what does need to be clear is what is real and what is fake. You need to know what you're looking at, whether you're actually listening to Trump or you're listening to an AI-generated version of Trump. And there, I think that there is a role for regulators, because I think transparency is important. Whether you like what you see or not, that's a different question, but you should be able to see stuff and know what's real and what's not. And I think that's going to be very important in terms of who wins and who loses, because the capacity to be able to label what is real and what is not a simple thing. It's going to be only players with big capacity, the ability to actually roll something like that out at scale, they're going to be capable of doing these things. So you might have a few players that are winners, and then a lot of people who just can't overcome the regulatory hurdles that are coming away around this. But it's definitely not a topic the government can ignore. They have to step in and set some guidelines that both encourage competition and innovation, but also protect us from all the bad stuff that can happen if people don't know what the truth is anymore.
And I think we already, government can have a positive, negative role, right? In this, we've already seen, you know, certain governments already bias, you know, the output that's coming out to suit their particular agenda. And I, you know, obviously we live in free markets, only in the Western democracies, we don't like that, right? So, whereas in many other countries, we're already seeing regulation, or they're just completely switching off the answers so that you know, they can't corrupt anybody's, you know, thinking, which will be necessary against their own policies and philosophies is probably the better word. I think that's a super important topic. I think it's probably where, if we you know, do this podcast again in 12 months' time, I think it's probably where we see some evolution, you know, developing. And I know that we've got future podcasts coming up to tackle the AI regulation and the challenges around that. And so we will certainly leave that for another time. So gentlemen, we're going to stop there. Obviously super, super interesting. You know, thanks for coming on again. Thanks for enlightening us on what's going on. Obviously it's a very, very fast moving topic. I might even have you on next month and we'll maybe have a different view about something by then. But it's again, super interesting. Thank you very much for kind of breaking it down into it. It's still a huge topic. But, you know, again, I found it very interesting. I hope you I hope the listeners found it very interesting as well. So thank you very much. So that wraps us up for Beyond the Benchmark for this week. Again, please do write to us if you think there's some controversies that you want to tackle, or indeed there's topics that you like us to tackle going forward. So again, thank you very much, and speak to you again soon.